This is the first meeting of a reading group we want to start. Hope it works. Basically, we don't have any experts here on the topic, which makes it even better. And the idea is just to work about talk about Hopf algebras and applications in physics. Okay, so this is just a really slight introduction to Hopf algebras. As you know, Hopf was a famous mathematician, so he had other things like Hopf vibrations, but there's no relation with this. So, and if you want some reading material, there's this set of lecture notes on the archive. They have some examples in case you want to compute some more examples. No, this is, it's okay. 43, 85. This is by Alessandra Flavetti. Okay. So first, like a really tiny historical introduction. So Hopf algebras were introduced in 1941. But it wasn't until 1987 when the first non-trivial examples. So mathematicians were just playing with the formal definition, but really interesting examples appear just in the 80s. And physicists are like looking at this thing, became interesting, and then really important results, Kramer and Alan Cohn in 1998. They saw a relation between Hopf algebras and perturbative renormalization. Okay. So some of the applications of this thing in physics, I don't know much about this. So maybe we can explore these things. I mean, it's up to all of us to see what's interesting and what's not interesting. There's applications in, as I say, perturbative RG. There's applications in integrability. There's applications in topological order, in extensions of Kitaev small in two dimensions. There's some results that Liz Molling mentioned to me in quantum gravity, renormalization of spin foams. And 2 plus 1 gravity coupled to matter. I mean, there's some example where people have used Hopf algebras in physics. So, like, we can see what's interesting in the end and which of these topics we can explore on. Okay, so now let's start the interesting part. So first of all, let's say what an algebra is. Really short introduction. I'm going to draw a line here. Put an example there. So an algebra is just a triple, A, M, U, where A is just a vector space over some field K. So let's write it this here. K can be either the real numbers, the complex numbers, or some finite field if you're more fancy. We're going to be dealing with the complex numbers. So every time you see k, just think of c, complex numbers. And we will have these m and u. These are k linear operations. So m goes from a tensor a to a. Basically, what it does is takes a1 tensor a2 and maps it to the product. And then you have the unit goes from the field into the algebra. So it takes some number and maps it to the number times the identity in A. Right? And yeah, I mean, you just define it like this, and then you extend it by linearity to the rest. Yeah, just a shorthand. But yeah, you're right. I mean, you have to extend this to by linearity. So I can put some indices here if you want. Okay. And yeah, these two maps will be k-linear. Okay, so what's interesting about this is that we can draw the following diagrams. So these diagrams are kind of trivial in this way, but we will see why it's nice to write these diagrams. Here's a multiplication. Here is identity tensor the multiplication. This is the multiplication tensor the identity. And this diagram commutes. So this is just associativity, right? So if I have three elements in the algebra, if I multiply the first two, then multiply with the third one, it's the same as multiplying the second and the third one, and then the first one. So that's just associativity. And we also have this other thing here that also this looks even more trivial. Is unit tensor identity. This is identity tensor unit. So this is telling us that clearly if we take the algebra and we tensor it with the complex numbers, let's say, if it's a complex algebra, then it's just the same as the algebra, right? If you just put some complex numbers in front, it's the same as just having elements in the original algebra. So, and here this is just the identity map. This is the multiplication. So this is just telling us that, okay, there's a question. Hi.
Hi. So we've got a couple of questions. Can you either respond to these messages or?
Yeah, I'm going to put the microphone next to the speaker, so. Okay.
So we just asked, is the tensor product over the field K?
Yeah. What? My gosh. So what happens with the tensor product?
Is the tensor product over the field K?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Okay, can you explain? Yeah, another question?
I have another one.
Okay, they were sorted, thanks.
Okay. This is associativity. So this map is just saying that the algebra is associative. And this is basically telling us that this is like a unit. So this is just like the property of the unit is that you can put the complex the field inside the algebra, like in this way. This is just telling us, yeah. I mean, so at this point, this is like just a fancy way of writing things we use all the time with algebra. This one is telling you that, let's follow, let's say, this route. So this is taking an element, let's write it like here. So you take some like lambda tensor A, right? So if we follow this thing, then this is telling us that this will map it to lambda identity in A tensor A. And now if we multiply them, this is just telling me that this is lambda A, right? So here, nothing is happening. This is just identity map. And this is telling me that if I take elements of this form, this thing is basically the same as lambda A. So that's more or less what's going on. Yeah, so here we have the multiplication in the algebra, and here is just the multiplication in the vector space. Okay.
Hi, can you please repeat people's questions from the audience? We can't hear your audience.
Ah, okay.
Just repeat the question to the video.
The question was about the product with K. Right, that... What was the meaning of this diagram, and what was the meaning of this? Is that more or less the question? Yeah. Okay.
I think you can even say that this is a fancy way of just saying that your algebra has a unit element.
So it probably helps looking at this diagram this way.
Yeah, so Oliver is saying that this is just a statement that the algebra has a unit. So, yeah, thank you. I think that's going to be useful.
The idea is that basically you take the neutral element in the field, and then you can promote it using this map, what is, I think it's mu or eta, to actually an algebra element that does nothing. Because it tells you that if you multiply that element, you get back... the element A you started from, that's what Sebastian wrote on that side of the backboard.
Okay. Now let's do a really simple example just to illustrate this. And we're going to develop this example. So that's it here. So take G, be a finite group. And then we will define KG to be elements of this form. Right, so this is just using all the elements of G as a basis for some vector space. And clearly, we can define a product here. So if we have the multiplication of, let's say alpha I G I with beta J G J, this will be just the sum over I and J of alpha I beta J G I G J. Probably shouldn't use G. Okay. This okay, it's a finite group, so this is enough. So you see that if the group is non-commutative, then this algebra won't be commutative. And that's okay. We have a unit in this algebra that is just the identity of the group. And then everything is okay. Right? Is this good for all of you? Okay, it's probably to be consistent with the notation I had before, I should put a tensor product here. Okay. All is good. So now let's define a coalgebra. So a coalgebra is a similar structure, and here it will be clear why I drew these diagrams on the right. So a coalgebra is a triple C delta epsilon. So it's that the same way, like C is just is a vector space. Over K, and we have the following K linear maps. So we have delta that goes from C to C tensor C, takes some element little c, maps it to something that we will denote in this way, C1 tensor C2. So this is the usual convention we use here. We omit the indices of summation, so it's just saying that we're going to kind of factorize C into like some product of elements and tensor product and then sum. So this sum is usually finite. So this is clear, right? I mean, in principle, I should write here some I, saying that this is like there's a different one for each one, and the sum is finite. But usually, people just omit the I's because there's no need for that. And then we also have, so this is called the coproduct. Write it here. I'm going to use the same line. I probably should write it here. This is the coproduct. Being too sloppy, it's okay. So we have epsilon that goes from C to the field, and okay, right now we cannot give a further characterization because it depends on particular Hopf algebra, but it's a map of this form. And this will be called the co-unit. Co-unit. So why do they have these names and what's the relation with this? So now we just take these maps and we're just going to invert the arrows. So that's a nice thing. If you ever forget the definition of a coalgebra, just write these things for algebras and invert all the arrows. So here we have this triple product. Now this arrow was going down, so now it's going up. So we have C tensor C. Here we have C. And here we have C tensor C, this is going up, this is going left, this is the coproduct. This is identity tensor coproduct, and this is coproduct tensor identity. And once again, this diagram commutes. So this is basic co-associativity or something like that. So in terms of this characterization of the coproduct, what this is telling us is that the delta of C1 tensor C2 is the same as C1 tensor delta of C2. Basically, is this saying us that if we expand each of these elements as, let's say, D1 tensor D2, then this saying us that we can take the things in any order. This is well defined.
Is it like we obtain from one element C some elements in C tensor product C, and then we apply once again some identity times delta, but like the element which we obtained in C tensor C is not generic, like is it?
What do you mean by generic?
It only depends on the original element of C, right?
Yeah, so not all elements we can obtain in this way.
Yeah, I mean, like, this is just like a...
So,
This is okay. I mean, for this is linear. This is something that is. These are linear maps. So you can extend this all by linearity. So you take some element C, then you apply the coproduct. You get this factorization here, right? It's a finite sum. Then if you apply the coproduct to the first element, then each element of the sum will factorize into a sum, like just in this way. So C1 will become some other sum.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing is that you get exactly the same result if you apply the coproduct to the second one.
Yeah. I think what Grisha wanted to say is that if the dimension of C is greater than 1, then this composed map is not going to be surjective, because the dimension of the triple tensor product will be higher than...
Yeah, I mean, we don't need it to be surjective.
What I wanted to say was that identity 2 will require... The identity on the right will require it for generic C1 and C2. The identity on the right.
On the right, this thing here.
Yeah, do we require for generic C1 and C2? Because, like...
Yeah, I mean, this is generic. In the sense that, I mean, here I'm assuming delta C is equal to C1 tensor C2, and then from this I go here. It's the same.
I mean, maybe I'm not understanding something, but like...
Repeat the question.
So I don't understand the question. That's
okay,
it.
So like... From acting from C, we're using delta to C tensor product C, we will obtain not a generic combination of C1 and C2.
Oh, okay, yeah, you're right. Yeah, I mean, this is not any combination. Okay. Yeah, you're right. I mean, yeah, this is not generic for any sum of C1 and C2. Yeah. Is what you're saying? And if I just take one element here in C, tensor C, and I do this thing, this won't be true in general, you're right. This is just... if this the composition comes from some other element, right, the coproduct. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I was submitting that. Okay, and now let's draw the other...
On this.
Sorry, another question about this. So this map is not necessarily subjective, right? And then you take C and map it to C tensor C. Then, like, you take one element, and in general, it's not mapped into some particular element, but a set of elements, right? Then what, like, how does this C tensor C and the C tensor C over there differ from each other? It's like, both of them are a set of elements.
They're not a set of.
No, this is a particular element in C tensor C.
Sorry, I mean, like, if I start from that corner over there, and you, I just don't understand, like this way and this way, you both take a delta map. Like,
okay, so
what's the difference?
These two arrows are doing the same thing, right?
Yeah.
This takes one element here, gives me the coproduct, and here you get the same, right?
So these two corners are actually the same.
Yeah, so I mean, if you follow the
differences
thing,
afterwards.
Yeah, so now if you expand the second element, or if you expand the first one,
okay,
you will get the same.
Okay.
Yeah, that's why people sometimes prefer to use the diagrams, because this notation is confusing in this context here. Okay. What's next? Oh, and the other diagram. So the other diagram, we just reverse the arrows. We have K tensor C. It's going up. C. This is C. Here this is going up. C tensor C. And this is C tensor K. This is going up. This is going right. This is going left. So here we have the coproduct. Here we have the identity. Here we have the identity. Here, this is just isomorphisms. This is epsilon tensor identity. And this is identity tensor epsilon. Basically, we just take this diagram and we invert all the arrows. So what does this mean in terms of this characterization? It means that C is equal to the sum of epsilon C1 C2, and this is equal to C1 epsilon C2. So you see, these are just numbers, so this is turning C into a linear combination of other elements.
What is the meaning of the tilde map when it goes up?
I mean, this is isomorphism, right? So you can just go up or down.
Yes, so you send the element of the vector space to identity of the field cross the element of the vector space. Is that this map?
Yeah, basically, there are many ways you can do it. Let's say you fix a basis for the algebra. It's a vector space. Let's say you fix a basis. Then you have an element lambda c in the vector space. You just map it to lambda tensor c. But you can also like map it back. So.
Yeah, but the problem is that a given element of the vector space can be decomposed in many ways into lambda.
I know. In either way, you always get this isomorphism. Like, it's well defined. You can show that it's an isomorphism of algebra. So everything is well behaved.
If we define a whole.
And it's still, I remember that this tensor product is k linear. So this thing, probably that would make this easier. This is equal to this. Because this tensor product is over k.
So you're back to the vector space A?
What I'm saying is that the algebra C is isomorphic to C tensor K.
Yeah, but why do you have the identity A?
Because A has an unit. At the beginning. Right?
When I did see C.
Ah, C, okay. So in this case, what I mean, sorry?
Yeah,
you want
the identity.
Identity in C.
Yeah.
I think.
Of course, this is one. The unit of the. Yeah, I think this is just the unit of the of the vector field of the field. Okay. So this is just one, the one in the complex numbers or the real numbers or whatever field you want. Yeah, thank you. Okay, so everything's okay now? We're happy? Okay. So now, we going to keep doing this example here. So I'm going to erase this. And so if we follow this example, so we have kg, and then we're going to define the coproduct as just g tensor g for every g in g. And we're going to define the co-unit of g as just 1. So this is a trivial example, but it's good to have this in mind. So nothing happened here, right? So this is delta, just a map from C to, or this vector space here, to the tensor product, and this goes from the vector space to the field. So everything is okay, right? So I mean, this is not too interesting right now, but it's going to become more interesting. So we're happy. So this is, we have now the notion of an algebra. We have the notion of a co-algebra. So now we can define a B algebra or pi algebra, or I don't know. Where can I write this? I'm going to write it here. Is it too sloppy? Is okay? Too big? Too small? Okay. So this quintet B M U delta and epsilon is a P algebra if B M U is algebra, B delta epsilon is a coalgebra, and of course there might be some compatibility here. So the you can see this, right? Well, I should take this up a bit. And the compatibility is either that delta and epsilon are algebra morphisms, or equivalently, I mean, one implies the other, so this is all good. M and U are co-algebra morphisms. So I won't explain in detail here by what I mean by this. This is just, you play around with the definition, like all the morphisms in algebra are just the same thing. So this is rough idea.
But maybe it might help to write down what, say, condition one means. For example, I mean, what it means is that if you have delta of an algebra product, so say delta of A times B, that this is the same as delta of A times delta of B. That, for example, might help to visualize what's going on.
Yeah. So what do I mean by this? Thank you. So we know that this will tell me, let's write it here. So what does it mean that delta is an algebra morphism? Is that delta of A times B, as Oliver was saying, is delta of A times delta of B, right? The same for epsilon, so epsilon of A times B is just epsilon of A times epsilon. Right? This is okay. And well, if you start playing around with this condition, you can show this is equivalent to, I mean, this is enough, right? Because these two conditions are equivalent, so if you guarantee that you have this compatibility, then you're okay. This is okay? So you see here, this is the product in the algebra. That's why it's a non-trivial compatibility condition. Okay.
I perhaps wasn't listening very well. So did you say that these two, the conditions 1 and 2, are equivalent?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, they are equivalent. So let's write here EQ.
Can you write explicitly what it means that what is co-algebra morphism? Like what is that M and U are co-algebra morphism?
What's the definition of a co-algebra morphism?
Yeah, what does it mean in terms of, like, you wrote about delta and epsilon?
Yeah. Well, let's try this. Okay. Let's see if I can make sense of this. Let me remember what I mean by this. This is taking like B tensor B takes it to B and then takes it to B tensor B. No. Yeah. Yeah, this is okay. This condition is here I use multiplication, here I use the co-product, and what this is telling me is this is equivalent to use what am I saying? Oh, do you really need this definition? I don't have it right now.
No, I just wanted to understand what does the second condition
mean. I mean, like, I didn't write it because I find these things a bit boring from a mathematical point of view. Like, all morphisms in algebra are just something that goes from one object to another that preserves all the algebraic structure. So that's a morphism in algebra. So they're all the same. If you have two groups, then it just preserves the group multiplication. If you have two algebras, then it preserves the linearity and preserves the product. Like, all morphisms are just the same.
Just intuitive for me, what does it mean, like, the second, like, how does this work for algebras, but
okay. Okay, yeah. So, I mean, like, what does it mean that M and U are coalgebra morphisms?
Yeah.
That's what you're saying. Okay, so take a coalgebra. Take another coalgebra. Define a morphism somehow, and then M and U will be that. I mean, I'm being sloppy here, but...
Did you switch them on purpose? Like, before mu and u were acting on that, were objects of the algebra, and delta and epsilon were associated to the coalgebra.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, like, they are compatible with the other structure. I mean, yeah. Otherwise, that makes sense. Yeah, I'm sorry, it's not too satisfying. And your mathematician is kicking me right now, but whatever. Okay, I'm sorry. Okay, so this is a coalgebra, a bialgebra. Is that clear for everyone? I'm really sorry I was being rude to mathematicians, but yeah. Okay. So now, let's define something more complicated. Is the notion of an antipode. So now, I'm going to bring this down. Bring this any questions so far? Is everything clear? So for example, you can check that this example we have been developing here, with the finite group, is effectively a bialgebra. It's a couple of lines of proof. You can have it as an exercise. We can do it if you're really confused. Is everything clear so far? Okay, now let's move to something a bit more exotic. It's the idea of an antipode. Okay. Antipode. So let's have this A, M, U on algebra. Then take C, delta, epsilon, a coalgebra. And take this. So this is just a fancy name for all the linear maps that go from C to A. A is F is K linear. Right? So we're going to define the convolution in this space. We're going to define it in this way. So C goes to C tensor C through the coalgebra. Now we go from C tensor C to A tensor A. How? F tensor G. So here we have Should I write this here? F and G are elements in this, and here we go to A through multiplication, right? So this goes from C to A. So this is an element of this space. It's linear because everything is linear here. And basically, this just tells me that F convolution G acting on some element C is just the sum of F C1 G C2, where C1 and C2 are just the composition of C with respect to the coproduct. This is, yeah, these two things are just the same. So this is called, let's write it here, this is the convolution. Is this okay?
Why do we need the most left arrow?
Because from, I mean, you need a map that, I mean, this is a product, so you can show. Let's write this here on the left.
Ah, okay, I got it.
Yeah, you can prove this, that home CA. Star and U composed with epsilon is a unital algebra. So this is an algebra with a unit that is associative and everything. So the unit in this algebra will be epsilon composed with U. Okay, so that's why we're defining it this way. So that's why we have this from C to A, because this gives me an element in the thing. Okay.
Do you need a delta here?
Sorry?
In the definition of convolution, do you need first a delta acting on C?
Yeah, of course. I need a delta because I need to go from C to A.
Yeah, well,
I want to use F and G.
Yeah, I was just looking at the equation in the box.
Oh yeah, I mean here of course, because C is I mean the C1 and C2 come from C by the coproduct. So yeah, every time you see C1 and C2 comes from some C to the coproduct. So everything is good so far. So now we have the interesting definition. The definition is so let H be a bialgebra. Right? So if S convolution, the identity is equal to the identity convolution. S, this is equal to the unit. Then S is called antipode. Okay? So basically, you see that H is a bialgebra, so here the coalgebra and the algebra will be the same space, so we're using the same elements. So this home from C to A is just home from H to H, so are just right like linear maps from the same space to the same space. And this is telling me that if you take the identity that is trivially like a linear map from H to H, then if I find the inverse, this is the inverse with respect to this convolution, then that element will be called the antipode, right? So it's like the inverse of the identity.
So if H is now a by algebra, then U circle epsilon is, how do you think of it?
This is the unit of this algebra. So what's U tensor epsilon for? Maybe this is like epsilon. We say it goes, let's say for this example, goes from H to K. U goes from K to H. So U epsilon just goes from H to H. Right? So that will be the
it's
unit.
Not identity as in identity.
No. So exactly, this thing here, this identity, is the linear map that is the identity inside H. So it just takes element A into element A. So nothing is happening there. But this thing is a different map. But this map turns out to be the identity of this. Do you want me to show? Maybe, yeah, let's do this.
But is it just some isomorphism?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Let's do something. I'm going to prove that this thing is the identity.
I think what one could say is that this star is just a different multiplication that you, apart from the multiplication mu, the original one that you have on the algebra. Now you define this star, and you need to find a new unit map for this new star. And it turns out that this u after a epsilon is the new unit for that thing.
Yeah,
but it's not the identity map on the algebra as a vector space.
Yeah, exactly. So if you have here the same space, C and A are the same space, then you have a trivial multiplication that is the composition of linear maps. But that's not the product. These are different products. This will be precisely a convolution. It will be a different one. So let's prove that this element here is the unit of this algebra, just to make things better. But let's keep this definition of the antipode in mind. So where I'm going to write this, I don't know. Now what I'm going to do, I'm going to take front up, the middle up, and the yeah. Okay, so let's say if you have F that belongs to the homomorphisms of C to A, I mean this holds in general, right? So what's this? F convolution with U epsilon applied to some element C. So what's this? How does this act? This is just the multiplication in A of these elements, of the sum of F C1 tensor U epsilon C2. Right, so here I take C, I apply the coproduct, and then I apply F to the first element, and U compose with epsilon to the second. And what's this? This is just the sum of F C1 epsilon C2. But now I use the fact that F is linear, so this is just F of the sum of C1 epsilon C2. Do you remember that we say that the co-unit satisfies this? So, and you can do the same with this product like in the other order. So here I'm showing you that if you take F and do a convolution with U composed with epsilon, if you apply it to every element in C, then you will get exactly F of C. So this means that this is the identity. Is it now like more concrete? So this is why U composed with epsilon is the unit of, I mean, with respect to this convolution. Okay. So we're happy. So now we can write here, we can complement the definition we had before. So H, if H has an antipode, if H is a bi-algebra with an antipode, H is called Hopf algebra. So, and we finish the definition of a Hopf algebra. So, I mean, just the definition of the Hopf algebra, as you see, is like big enough. It has structure of a algebra, has the structure of a coalgebra, and it has this idea of the antipode through this convolution. So it's a pretty bulky definition. So why is this so complicated? Well,
is this S?
Yeah, you can prove playing with the definitions that S is unique. Okay, so.
So M acting on mu is what?
What's that again?
When you have M acting on mu, I don't.
Yeah, so this, I mean, we are following this path here, right? So you take an element in C, mm-hmm. then you expand it with the coproduct, then you apply the first map to the first one and the second map to the second one. So here I'm applying F to C1, and I'm applying U composed with epsilon to the second one,
yeah.
Right?
And then you apply M to that.
Yeah, so now what's epsilon times C2? Well, we say that epsilon goes from the thing, so this is an element in K, right? So when I take U of epsilon C2, this is just giving me epsilon C2, that is an element in the field, times the identity in A.
Okay.
So here I'm just multiplying them and the identity disappears. So okay, everything is okay? Okay, I hope everything is okay in Bristol, because we didn't get any questions. All right. So this is the definition of a Hopf algebra. So as you see, it's like pretty big. But what's interesting about this Hopf algebra is that you can both extend the notion of groups and Lie algebras under the same hood. So this is the interesting part, that this definition is big enough to contain completely different structures and things that are natural, for example, from the point of view of algebras. You can define them for groups and vice versa. So that's why this definition is this big. And of course, I haven't told you about this. This is the next thing. What are the properties of this antipode? So this antipode has some useful and important properties. So I'm going to erase the coalgebra. What's it again? I'm sorry.
The S and ID, they belong to homomorphisms of from C to A.
In where S? Where?
Like what is the nature of those objects S and ID?
Okay, yeah. So this, because here H is a bi-algebra, then this is acting on the same space. So here C is equal to A. C is equal to A is equal to H. Just the same vector space.
So is it possible for H not to have this antipode?
I guess.
So
that's
the definition of a Hopf algebra, is a bi-algebra with an antipode.
Exactly. But it must have an antipode. Yeah, if you define like a weird weird bi-algebra that doesn't have an antipode, then it's not a Hopf algebra.
So what's the use of this algebra that has the homomorphism of CA? Is that just an example?
What's it again?
So this homomorphism of CA is there, is that some example of...
No, it shows that the definition is more general. Like you can define convolution.
It's not connected to Hopf algebras.
Yeah, no, I mean, like, if you make it concrete, yeah. But this definition of the convolution, you can define it for any algebra and coalgebra. Just. How mathematicians like it. Fuck. See you. Oh my god, it's broke. I know. We're making fun of poor can of like all covering Chuck. It's really easy. Okay. Yeah, I know. Okay, nice. So now that's draw a diagram and let's write the property. So what is this antipode threeness in terms of diagrams? We have this nice diagram. Okay, so once again, these diagrams commute. So what's interesting about the antipode is that this diagram is not inspired by the algebra diagram. This is inspired by the diagram of the inverse in a group. So you see that if you have the inverse in a group, what you have is you have some element, you can map it to the diagonal, and then you can just invert one of them. And if you multiply it, you end up with the identity. Okay, so this is inspired by the inverse in the group. I'm not going to be more precise about this. There's this funny thing called the field with just one element. That is like F1 or fun for the French people. And this field has the property that if you try, it's like a formal object, but if you define a Hopf algebra over this field, it's basically you get a group. Just trivia. So what are the properties of this antipode? S of H times G is just S of G times S of H. The antipode, when it's applied to the identity in the Hopf algebra, it just gives you the identity in the Hopf algebra. Take the coproduct of the antipode. It's just the sum of the antipodes of each one. Yes. Two. And take epsilon. S, H, it's just epsilon H. Question?
I think there is one detail in the third line where you split the H1 and the H2 components. Because I think you'd need exchange H1 and H2 on the right hand side.
So, oh, okay. Oh, yeah, you're right. I'm sorry, yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Two, one. Yeah, thank you. So, yeah, this is inverting the order, these things. Yeah, S goes from the algebra to the algebra.
And when you say I,
I was I.
I sub H is just
this is what the unit in the algebra.
Yeah.
When you apply the antipode you get
So what's the meaning of H1 and H2 then? Why do we embed it? Does it mean?
Just happens to be that way. I mean, you can prove this from the definition. This tells you that if you take S, you take an element, you get the antipode of that element through S, and then you apply the coproduct. It's related to the original one by flipping this and taking the antipodes of the element.
Yeah, but can't you relabel them in H1?
I think this is under the definition that delta of H is equal to the sum of H1 tensor H2.
Yeah, of course. I mean, every time I write 1 and 2, it's just the same thing.
Okay.
Yeah, it's just trivial. It's the same notation.
When you said relabel, there is one thing one needs to be careful. Because in general, if you take the coproduct of an element, the left and the right tensor factors that you get are not equal.
Mm-hmm.
So it's only in the case of a group that the result is in fact symmetric. And well, in the general case for certain special elements, so you cannot usually just permute the left and the right coproduct factors.
Yep.
Hi.
Hi.
So we'd like to know if you know what the antipode is in the Kohn-Kreimer-Hopf algebra.
Oh, I don't know. That's, if we're going to keep doing renormalization, I'm going to hang up. If we're going to keep doing renormalization, like perturbative renormalization with Hopf algebras, then we will see what the antipode in that concrete example is. I know that the Hopf algebra they use in perturbative renormalization is related to trees, because it's given by some combinatorics. That's all I know. And the structure is more complicated. So yeah, I don't know. I only know the simple example. Okay. So this is everything okay, so we're happy. And now let's go back to our example and do a non-trivial, a little bit less trivial example. So we had our example, so let's bring this down. So okay, so here you have G, finite group. So we had this multiplication, we had the unit was just lambda times E, where E is the unit of the group. We say that the Kohn product is just the diagonal, because we're lazy, and this is just 1. So now, what's the antipode? What do you think is the antipode? G to the minus 1. So, and you extend this by linearity, of course. Basically, you take any element and then you just invert it. So in this case, it's a really, really simple antipode. And you can prove like that everything is compatible. You can prove, for example, let's do this here. If you multiply S this is just the multiplication of S, G, G. This is just G minus 1, G, and this is just the identity. I mean,
do I understand it right that we should define G like on linear combinations of elements of a group now?
Yeah, so everything is extended by linearity.
Okay, what is S of some linear combinations of Gs? Because like inverse.
Okay, yeah, so let's say S of sum of alpha G is just sum of alpha G minus 1. Okay, so this is, now let's do a less trivial example that is related to the notion of quantum groups, but I'm just going to do an abelian group, so I like it. Everything is happy and abelian, so nothing weird is going to happen. Okay, so where should I write this? Put this up. Okay. Is there any questions so far? Side Kramer Kohn. For example, if you remember when I started, I gave a reference on the archive. I think they developed that in that paper, so that would be a fast reference for the primer cone. Hopefully, the one they use for perturbative RG. So that's for Chris. Okay. So now the other example I'm going to do. So let's define S0 of S1. This is, you know, S1 is the circle. So this is just the functions. We go from S1 to the complex numbers, such that every epsilon greater than 0, x, there's a compact containing S1, compact. Such that norm of f of x is less than epsilon for every x in the complement of k.
Since S1 is compact, couldn't we just call these the continuous functions on S1?
Oh, yeah, everything is continuous. Yeah. Okay. So what? This is just a fancy way of saying that if you have the function on the circle, it's bounded in some way. I mean, it's compact, so it's kind of trivial. But okay. And so this is just some functions over the circle. Just don't worry too much about this. The nice thing is that we have Fourier series. So for every f, we can write it as some ck e to the I k theta, where k goes from minus infinity to infinity. So these are just Fourier series for functions on the circle. I mean, if you have functions on the circle, this is equivalent to having functions, a periodic function on the real line. So, okay. And so using this, we can do the following identification. We can say that this space is basically just the formal series developed in this way by these two elements, where set is just e to the I theta. And of course, set to the minus 1 is e to the minus theta. I theta. Okay? So now you see that this is an algebra. How would you define an algebra in this case? The product of the algebra? I mean, this is a vector space, of course. If you take two functions, you add them, it's still a function. It's an algebra because if you multiply two functions, then you say that f, g, at some point theta, is just f of theta times g of theta. So you can define pointwise multiplication. So this will be an algebra. So now how we define the co-algebra structure in this space.
So what is complexity of the
matrix? This is just a name for like the formal series developed on this. Like, see, if you put C here, then there are some, these are just constant numbers. These numbers, I mean, complex numbers. So this is just a formal series with complex coefficients. Okay. And here then the co-product of set will be a set tensor set. So in this case we still keep the diagonal minus one. It's just set minus one. The unit, the co-unit, I mean, one. Okay, so you see, for example, if you take the co-unit and you apply it to any function, it will just give you the evaluation at zero. Theta equal to zero. And you have the antipode, and the antipode is what you will expect. Okay, this is okay, right?
Does it follow from the axioms for the coalgebra what the delta applied to some power of z is null? If we have this?
What's that again?
If we know that delta of z is z tensor z, then does it follow from the axioms of the coalgebra what we obtain if we apply delta to some power of z?
Some power of z, okay.
I'm not sure if it follows from
it does from the
it, ah, yeah, it does from the compatibility condition. When we define the co the bi-algebra, we say that the co-product should be algebra morphism.
Okay.
So if you have
you have to assume it's a bi-algebra.
Okay. I mean if you extend this make everything compatible. Okay, so some remarks. First of all, if you apply the co-unit to any function, it will give you write this here on the right. Some interesting things. First of all, if you apply epsilon on the function f, it's just f at theta equals zero. Right? And if you think of these as elements in the algebra, in the group, I mean in the U1 group, this is just F applied to the identity of U1. If you go back, the antipode of F, this will be a function over the group. So if you apply this to some element in U1, can show from this that this is just f g minus 1. Right? So this is interesting because now we have an algebra. This algebra is the functions over a group, and everything works out nicely.
Not of the coefficients of Fourier series, but just on functions?
You can do it too.
So what will be delta of a function?
Delta of a function. The delta of a function will just give you the, let's think about this. If you have delta of f, this should act on x tensor y. And this should give you f of xy, where x and y are elements in S1 or U1. Because, I mean, if you take delta of f, it will give you something that acts in the tensor product
I give you a pair of functions, no?
Mm-hmm. So, am I doing this right? No. No, no, no. No, no, no. I, this should give you this, right? Am I doing this right? No. No, no, it's what I had before. Because here, you identify, this is something I didn't say. That's why I was working with finite groups before, because in for infinite groups, it's a bit more complicated. Here you have, you identify the functions of identify these with this. Yeah, this is always true in finite groups. In infinite groups, you have to be careful with the functions you're choosing. So now, once you make this identification, then this makes sense.
I still don't understand. Can we write down explicitly those two functions which we obtain when we apply delta to one function?
The pair of functions on the circle is like a function of torus. So the function of torus is the f of x, y, where x and y are the two coordinates on the torus.
Is that okay?
For example, we are given some particular function on a circle. Okay, now applying delta, we obtain two functions. Of course, we can say that the pair of function acts on pair of arguments given the product of this stuff. And this will be f of x, y. But we can also explicitly say that those functions are not just their product.
Okay, let's, we can maybe do this more explicit. Let's say, what is this thing doing? So let's say that f, see if we manage to make this work. Sum over all k's of ck e to the I k theta, right? So delta of f should be sum over k of ck e to the I k theta e to the I k phi.
You mean right? Deltas or products?
Yeah, it's the same as just taking two.
I mean, is it a product or tensor product or
it's the same. In this case, it's the same. It's like having, if you have function of x, function of y, it's just like an element in the tensor product. So each of these, you can put here a tensor product if you want, but now we're taking a sum. And now this thing will give you e to the I k theta plus phi. That is just, yeah. So it's this. Is that okay? I mean, here I'm just using the there's a lot of things that are isomorphic to some other things. Okay, so this is all I had to say for today.